Think about how many people were employed by the Sullivans and Smithicks families over the last 300 years. It's a big deal, and it's emotional, and people have had generations of their families working for the Sullivans or the Smithicks. So it was the crystallizing point in us saying we're going to stand up and do the right thing and bring brewing back to Kilkenny.
That's Michael Mead, a businessman from Buffalo, brewing beer in Kilkenny, reviving a 300-year-old brand, Sullivan's. And I'm John Lee.
And I'm Martin Nutty. Welcome to another episode of Irish Stew, the podcast for the global Irish nation.
This episode is sponsored by Shantella, your all-in-one business launchpad in the United States. Committed to excellence in execution, Shantella helps enterprises enter or expand in the U.S. market through bespoke project management and strategic planning solutions. Create and realize your vision with Shantella, where they invest their passion in your future success. To learn more, go to shantella.space. Yes, .space. It's a thing.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back. This is Martin Nutty, and you're listening to the Irish Stew podcast and On Tap today.
Yes, On Tap, Martin. Good way to put it. It's the second episode in our occasional Irish libation series, and today the topic is what's on tap. And what's on tap is beer, or more accurately, perhaps ale. Joining us today is Michael Mead, who diverted from a successful Wall Street career to go on a quest to revive an over 300-year-old Irish ale brand, Sullivan's, from one of the great traditional centers of Irish brewing, Kilkenny. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Good to have you aboard. You know, we're going to explore your roots. You're from Buffalo, which people don't realize has an amazing Irish-American history to it. We'll look at your career in finance and what diverted you off onto the course of breweries. But before we get into that, let me just ask you, kind of set the scene. I'm going to ask you to imagine the perfect beer drinking experience. Where you are, what's the setting, what's going on around you, who are you with, and most importantly, what are you drinking?
Interesting. Well, I mean, the perfect setting, that's a high bar. But in general, amongst friends or colleagues, a group setting's always best. Obviously, it's never all that wise to be hanging around by yourself and taking part in drinks. I think that's generally discouraged.
Good rule.
I enjoy really anything ranging from deep, dark, authentic pubs in Ireland all the way up to today's beer bars with 100 taps in America. So I think it's all about both atmosphere and those you're surrounded with.
So we like to probe people's pasts.
Uh-oh.
And understand maybe something about your Irish connections. Mm-hmm. So as John mentioned, you're from Buffalo. And a lot of our listeners probably don't know a whole hell of a lot about Buffalo. And I will admit, I have never been there. I happen to occupy the same state, but I'm at the very bottom. And Buffalo's at the very top. So it's quite a long drive by car. I think it's probably about close to 10 hours. So with that said, tell us a little about your roots in Buffalo.
Well, you know, ultimately, a number of Irish nationals came up through either Ellis Island or Hoboken to the Buffalo area for sure. Chief among them, well, not chief among them, but chief among them in my own mind anyway, are my relatives with Dublin roots, specifically on my mother's side of the family. So, you know, my grandparents and my great uncle, great aunt, and so forth came up. The Donahue family, the Allen family, specifically to my mother's maiden name. My father's side apparently had trekked here earlier, and he recently passed away in the fall. So we've identified Irish roots, but more based on the Philadelphia side. Buffalo, near and dear to my heart for a lot of reasons. My school being amongst them, obviously lifelong friends. And only recently, since I've engrossed myself in Sullivan's, did I become more familiar with South Buffalo, which is a genuine enclave of Irish heritage and roots. A number of the street signs are actually similar to Ireland in both English and Irish.
Really?
And saying all that, we've got wonderful clients there, a number of bars and restaurants that carry our beers because they really gravitate towards anything that's authentically Irish. So we have kind of my history blending into Buffalo's history there. I believe if you kind of wiki it, you'll always find Buffalo to be in the top 10, if not even higher, in folks who identify of Irish heritage. So that's your surprise you allude to about being up there. And the last thing I'd mention, if you haven't been, it wouldn't be a waste. Niagara Falls is about 12 miles away, so you can see one of the wonders of the world, and that should be on the agenda. But also the National Trust for Historic Preservation, I believe it was 2012, it might have been 2014, but forgive me on that point, they held their national conference in Buffalo. And Buffalo's wealth and history was built really on the back of the Erie Canal. So I think a number of people came from around the country and just couldn't believe the beauty of the architecture and the buildings and so forth. And Olmsted himself, besides building Central Park, had built the entire kind of network of roads and circles and so forth and urban planning, including Delaware Park, which is the Central Park of Buffalo, if you would. So that's kind of the pride I have in Buffalo, if that sums it up well.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good tour de force historically. Just a point for our Irish listeners, Michael was kind enough to mention the Erie Canal, which I believe was completed in 1825, and a lot of times it's considered to be the first great national public work. I believe it's about 350 miles long and connects the Hudson River, which flows out of New York City, all the way to Lake Erie, which is part of the Great Lakes system, and Buffalo sits at the confluence of that canal and the Great Lakes, making it an extraordinarily important place for grain shipment.
That's right.
And the canal is really why New York's so important.
Exactly.
As a harbor in New York City.
You know, at the turn of, from the 1800s turning over into 1900, you had the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, 1903, I believe. President McKinley was assassinated there. So you have deep ties to the presidency in the United States. Millard Fillmore is from there. Teddy Roosevelt was sworn in after McKinley was shot. So there's some unique tie-ins that most people wouldn't anticipate. But the truth is, at that time, so the books say anyway, there were more millionaires in Buffalo, New York than there were in New York City at that time. And that's specifically around what you mentioned, Martin, which is grain and the Erie Canal.
It sounds like you're really invested in bringing out those great elements once again. We'll get into what you're doing with the beer. Maybe it's along a similar track. It sounds like you're very committed to reviving Buffalo.
Mm, absolutely. Yeah, you know, we'll get to the beer in a moment, but it was our first market for the beer just due to ties mostly driven from my high school experience, and that the large distribution family also went to my same high school. And so we have a lot of loyalty to each other up there.
So, yeah, just speaking about, you know, Buffalo again, of course, it goes into a period of decline starting in 1950. I think there's something like 580,000 people there, and it's kind of shrunk down most recently to about 278,000. But I noticed in the last census, 2020, that it's actually growing now.
Yeah.
So it's 6.5% growth in population. So something is stirring.
Mm-hmm.
What's stirring?
Well, I'd say two key things. One is a medical corridor, pulling the University of Buffalo's campus from the outskirts of downtown to literally downtown, and surrounding it with a, you know, Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center as a bedrock institution. There's only, I believe, 50 of those in the country. And so if you have, you know, a case that's serious enough, you're coming from a far away as Syracuse, Canada, and so forth to go to Roswell Park. Now it's surrounded by UB's medical school, Catholic Health, the brand new children's hospital, and so forth. So I'd say number one is medical care, which, by the way, has spurned growth in a lot of cities in America that had been previously down and out. Right. And you think of Research Triangle in North Carolina and so forth. Now, I think currently you're looking at a lot of innovation lab type of things, technology lab type of investment, both on a state basis and on a private basis. There's a 43 North and other incubators really trying to make Buffalo, you know, a place for tomorrow. And really, it was a place for yesterday.
Right.
So that's kind of inspiring. And I think, unfortunately, where some cities have fallen down is being cool and up and coming for younger folks. Say maybe a Portland, Oregon, in that example, with some of the urban problems they've been experiencing over the last 10 years. You know, I think Buffalo has really sought out how to fill that void a touch.
That's great. It's really, really encouraging. I'm from a, you know, New England in a town that used to be vibrant and the industry went away. So I'm really sympathetic. And I actually look at my town and I see so much potential, but, you know, it's not realized. And just one more Irish note about Buffalo. It's where that great collection of James Joyce material is, too.
Yeah, and so I was fortunate enough to be asked to tour the the James Joyce Museum. Now, it isn't really in a museum format yet. There's been, as you are well aware, the state has announced through Senator Tim Kennedy a funding level for that, an actual building of a site. But it was awfully exciting. I have a great picture of myself holding James Joyce's passport and his walking cane. So that's a bit of a thrill as an Irish American.
And of course, the current governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul, despite her, I'm assuming, Germanic name, is actually from Buffalo, but also of Irish ancestry. So again, it feels like Buffalo is firing on some different set of cylinders than it has been for the, you know, certainly the latter half of the 20th century.
That's right.
It is very much a new century, it feels like to me, in Buffalo. But you then, I noticed you went to Fordham,
mm-hmm.
and then fetch up on banking. so tell us about that. Long way from Buffalo. Mm-hmm. Buffalo's not known for being a banking center. New York City, where we're sitting right now, obviously is.
Yeah.
So was that part of the master plan? I think you did political science or something, as I recall it.
In Spanish, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
I've applied to very few colleges, and then it kind of dawned on me. Rowing had been my big sport growing up, and it dawned on me of the colleges I had been applying to that I felt that a path to a future, growing up quite middle class and whatnot, was to be in New York City. And that solidified my choice at Fordham. It didn't hurt that I knew folks from high school who were freshmen and sophomores, and really in all 4 years when I went to visit. I went to a Jesuit high school. It's easy to fancy a Jesuit college on that basis. And so that was the main driver. I thought to myself, where could I get an internship somewhere in the middle of Connecticut versus where could I get an internship somewhere in New York City? And by the way, sitting in a political science class late, second semester of freshman year, a junior came up to me and said, hey, you know, I work at Citibank at night at their mortgage, 1-800 number. Would you be interested in joining me? He probably got paid a little, you know, bottle of this or a bottle of that for recruiting. And so I did that really for almost all 4 years of college, where I would work 5 to 9 p.m. at their 800 number. And if you wanted to take Friday off, you had to do Saturday 10 to 2. So not studying business at what was then called the College of Business Administration at Fordham. I was in Fordham College, the more liberal arts focused area of the school, doing, like I said, doubling in Spanish and political science. It was my chance to kind of learn business.
So tell us about, you know, getting into big business here in New York. That's what makes New York what it is now. It was the Erie Canal, but now it's the world of high finance. How did you navigate that world?
I'll say this, you know, there are people that say you create your own luck, and that's kind of like a nice platitude. I think that without people caring about you and guiding you on your path in your career, you'd be doomed.
Yeah.
So I was still focused on rowing, and so I was selling insurance out of college so that I could row twice a day for New York Athletic Club and try to pursue those types of dreams. And then one day, somebody at my insurance office said, hey, can you come in and see me? And they said, you need to go talk to my friend Kevin Flack at Bankers Trust. I mean, he pretty much told me that's what I needed to do with myself. And it was nice because it was kind of coincidental with my winding down my rowing career. I was about 26 years old. And so I did. And Kevin ended up hiring me at Bankers Trust. Some of my lifelong friends are from that original desk there. Mm. Deutsche Bank then bought Bankers Trust. Boy, we thought we had a culture that was really unique, and we were really proud of it at BT, as they called it. Deutsche came in, a Yankee bank, and very few of us actually survived the move over there, at least in my businesses, in the fixed income trading businesses. So I was thankful to have a seat, and I also met my next level of lifelong friends at Deutsche. And then I asked Deutsche to move me out west, and so I had a good run, kind of Bankers Trust Deutsche of about 7 years, about 10, 11 years at Morgan Stanley, which I loved in every way, shape, and form. I also transitioned my career at Morgan Stanley from fixed income sales and trading to the hedge fund financing businesses, and I really enjoyed the switch. It kept me fresh and gave me a kind of my next lease on life to keep going in those trading floor businesses where you don't hang around all that long. And I ended my last 6 years at Citi, moved back to New York with Citi, downtown of the Tribeca headquarters, and And that's where I've been kind of ever since, only I haven't been at Citi for a good 6-7 years by now.
What do you think you learned there that set you up for this next adventure in the brewery business?
I think what you learn is that speed of answers actually matters, contrary to popular belief. Now, the best way to give a speedy answer is to not make a mistake when you're giving your speedy answer. So expediency shouldn't be at the expense of detail and correctness and thorough thought and so forth. But I do think thinking on your feet is a big part of it. I think understanding to listen to clients is a huge part of it. Oftentimes you witness a sales discussion and you watch people tell people what they need or what they want. I think learning the skill of understanding what's important to them is really the most important stepping off point for any kind of sales relationship.
So talk to me exactly how you transitioned from the world of high finance into the world of beer. That seems pretty dramatic.
Well, I mean, do you guys play background music at that point to make it sound more dramatic?
Good idea. Thanks. Let's make a note of that.
I don't know if it's that dramatic. I feel like it was my time in a lot of ways, for sure. 23 years of what I would call mostly intense work, for sure. And I had begun to develop my adult affinity for Ireland at around the 2005 timeframe when I wanted to see U2 play at Croke Park in Dublin. And that was my first trip over. And, my main takeaway was, wow, I had been to many places in the world covering central banks and stuff like this. And I said, hey, wait a minute, this still feels exotic and they speak English. So yeah. I can do this in a little bit of a different way. And that began my kind of immersion into Ireland for the first time. And then I had heard that the Smithick family had been wanting to get back into the brewing business. Mm. And so I approached them through a friend in Connecticut, actually. And they took a meeting and I flew over from San Francisco for 24 hours on New Year's Eve day, December 31st, 2014, where they had already been trying to hatch the idea of reemerging in the beer business. But I felt like I was there, in one of the first conversations at the same time.
Well, maybe you could sort it out for us then, because you say Smithicks, and everybody knows they can go into any pub and get Smithicks, and it's been there forever. But you're talking about Smithicks getting back into the business. So what were some of the history there that put them on the outside, even though their brand name is still there?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. If you think about a town today, Kilkenny City, a medieval city, and city is a stretch by our terms, right? Its population is probably today only 25,000 people. God knows what it was in 1700, but in 1702, the Sullivan's family instituted and began their brewing business in Kilkenny. And 8 years later, the Smithicks instituted and began their brewing business in Kilkenny. So just think about that for a second. In the 1700s and 1800s, two families from a tiny-ish and medieval city are exporting beer to as far away as Australia, Canada, North America, the continent of Europe, of course. So that's unique. So again, Sullivan's founded in 1702, the Smithicks 1710, and most people will have 1759 associated with Guinness running around in their head. It is interesting to then back up and think about what that means in line with other events that have happened in the world. And you think about the French Revolution, the American Revolution and whatnot. It's really something else that these two families have been brewing and selling beer globally for so long. And what eventually happened was, and I'll stick just to the Smithicks side for a minute, they began becoming a publicly traded company in the 1900s and selling shares, that means, of course. And Guinness had slowly been acquiring those shares. Mm. Guinness completely acquired the Smithicks Brewery in 1965. And today, when we think of Guinness, we actually think of an English company, Diageo, that was formed in 1998. And in that formation of what I'll call the spirits and beer and other consumer products conglomerate, the Smithicks family's trademarks were sucked up into that fold with Guinness. And of course, Guinness would be Diageo's flagship product, really. Now, meanwhile, there's a lot of interesting history on the Sullivan side that had gone down. And if we just fast forward and accept that we have seen archival sketches of are Sullivan's wooden barrels in Boston Harbor in the 1800s and so forth. Really, really unique and neat provenance to the brand, heritage to the brand. When you look at the fast forward to people, and I'll digress here for a minute, people always ask me, you know, what's Ireland like if they haven't been? And I always say, well, these small villages, what do they have? They have 8 to 10 pubs. They have a chipper for some greasy food after you have a couple pints. And they have a minimum of 2 bookies. So I don't think it's any secret to your listeners that the Irish have always loved the horses, right? So if you can believe it, in France in 1918, the leader of the Sullivan's clan bet the entire Sullivan's brewery on a horse race and lost. And I wish we were making that up because it sounds so outlandish, except for 15, 16 months ago, we finally located archival like sketches of the horse itself. And the name of the horse, which is Handcuff.
So, I feel their pain, as I've mentioned here many times. I used to work in horse racing for many years, and I know that sensation of putting it all on the line and your horse didn't get the memo.
Yeah, the horse didn't come in. The horse is still running. We've got different euphemisms and metaphors around it. But the truth of the matter is, and this would happen in modern beer as well, the Smithwick's family grabbed the trademarks and buried the Sullivan's brand. And so when Guinness acquired them, and you fast forward to 98, the Sullivan's trademarks were tucked over here on the side of the Smithwick's archives and so forth. And the real catalyst, and we can circle back to Buffalo on this thought, is in 2012, Diageo decided to close down the Smithwick's brewery in Kilkenny. And I don't want to over-exaggerate the point, but to bring it to a Buffalo or a Rust Belt kind of idea, yeah. You know, this is similar to closing Bethlehem Steel. Or think about what Youngstown, Ohio looks like today on a similar timeline to Buffalo. Think about how many people were employed by the Sullivan's and Smithwick's families over the last 300 years. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
And it's emotional. People have had generations of their families working for the Sullivans or the Smithwick's.
Right.
So it was kind of the crystallizing point in us saying we're going to stand up and do the right thing and bring brewing back to Kilkenny.
So talk to us about, I believe, the member of the Smithwick's family you deal with is Alan.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about that initial conversation and contact. And how is a guy from living in the West Coast of America with a big, broad American accent, all of a sudden convince a member of one of the Irish brewing dynasties to get into bed with each other? It's probably not the right term, but, you know, we'll go with that.
Yeah. Well, originally, like I said, December 31st, 2014, Alan was not in the room, Alan Smithwick. His uncle, Paul Smithwick, was in the room. And Paul's son, Dan Smithwick, was not in the room. Now, so I always think about it as Paul brought the band together. and I can tell you about that band in a moment if you'd like. But ultimately, on a day-to-day basis, Paul has since passed away, unfortunately, at kind of the life expectancy of a normal Irish man 2 years ago now. I deal with Dan Smithwick every day as my CFO, and I deal with Alan Smithwick every day as my head of commercial for Ireland. And those two gents are cousins. And Alan comes from the wholesale side of the family. And the neat thing about Alan is we grow our barley on his estate that goes into our beers. And Dan, of course, his father was Paul. And Dan, the handy thing about Dan is that he is a chartered accountant in Ireland and grew up at KPMG. And at Citibank, you know, earning his stripes on that side of the fort, which is critical to helping run a small company.
Well, you mentioned barley and the sort of local origins of it. What goes into reviving a beer or an ale? Did you really try to recreate something based on an old recipe? Was it more just taking the brand name and trying to stay true to the heritage?
Yeah.
How did you create these beers? I know you have an outstanding brewmeister.
Yeah. I mean, that's the key input. I think, so to answer the question directly, we're not using old recipes or archival recipes. We have the handy benefit of, I think some people know this and most don't, that for Guinness, one of their largest markets in the world is Nigeria. And Ian Hamilton, our master brewer, one of the original five founders with myself, Diageo had him stationed in Nigeria and Cameroon for 16 years. When he moved home to Kilkenny, as the master brewer of Guinness, by the way. When he moved home to Kilkenny, in the he won't like me saying this, but let's call it the twilight of his career. That's an exaggeration. He became the master brewer of Smithwick. And so when we set off to do this, it's sort of handy if you're making traditional Irish ales to actually know the recipe of both Guinness and Smithwick. That's a plus. Mm-hmm. Let's not diminish that. And I think we set out specifically to make ales that are true to the definitions of the styles, but distinct in flavor and so forth in terms of characteristics.
So let's just back it up a little bit here, because I like beer. I think John likes beer. But I will also plead ignorance to exactly what goes into beer. As I understand it, water, yeast, grain, and hops are usually the four main components. Is that what goes into your... and is there something special about Kilkenny, the terroir, so to speak, about that place that makes great beer?
Yeah. We'll start with water. Water is about 95% of the contents of beer is water, right? And so there are a few places around the world where the water table would be specifically recognized as just either perfect or of contributing value to the end product, right? For instance, a lager called Pilsner is from Pilsen in what is now Czechia or the Czech Republic. Burton-on-Trent, where we know Bass Ale was from, is a familiar name, known for its water table and what it would contribute to the ultimate beer flavor. And I would say Ireland in general is known for its limestone-rich water. And so Kilkenny or Dublin or wherever you're brewing in Ireland, you're dealing with a water table that is going to lend good enhancements to beer for sure. Yeah. Now, I think you also asked a little bit about lager versus ale in there.
Well, I was kind of curious because, again, you know, we throw these terms around, but I don't think they're particularly well understood. So if you can clarify that.
You have a stout, a golden ale, a lager, a red ale. What are we doing?
I think for purposes of this conversation, let's put at the top of the triangle the term beer. And under that, let's just put at the other two points in the triangle or the flow chart, ales and lagers.
Right.
And the way to think about those as types of beers is really... the primary difference will be the type of yeast used. And to generalize, and not wildly overgeneralize actually, ale yeast, the DNA components of ale yeast, are meant to impart flavor to beer. They're meant to impart oftentimes what they call esters or an aura into the beer that oftentimes has a fruity characteristic to it. Whereas lager yeast is specifically meant to be neutral and not to impart flavor into beer. So that would be your loose definition. Now, there's all kinds of ways we can go underneath both of those points on the scale. What we brew specifically for our ales are an Irish traditional dry stout. And you know that there's a big competitor in the space and a big dominator. Then we brew an Irish red ale, which we call Maltings. We named it that because Maltings is the name of our original building. Original brewery in Kilkenny. It's now occupied by the Cartoon Saloon, which has won, I believe, Academy Awards for different animation play. So Maltings Red Ale, which we call Irish Ale. Then we, 70% of the global beer market are yellow beers. So we went with, we designed a golden ale and we named it Irish Gold. And that would seem a little, you know, limericky or whatnot, except for the featured hop is called First Gold. So we feel like we're tipping our cap there to the hop that's imparting the most balance to the fruity esters I just mentioned, imparted by the ale strains.
And what's the strains. What's the role of a hop of hops in beers? They're kind of like flower buds or something.
They are. Right? Yeah. I think the way to think about hops versus grain is simpler than you'd guess. Let's start with grain. You could take a piece of barley and put it in a kiln for a short time. A long time at a lower temperature or at a higher temperature and produce different colors of the degree of that roast, right? And so you have pale ale malts, you have Vienna malts, I'm going out of order. You have everything all the way up to chocolate malt, which would look just like that. And so when we think of the colors of beer, oftentimes that's the malt driving that, okay? The degree of toast that you've put on your grains going in. And in general, the flowers you allude to in hops, there's a couple of factors there, but in general, they're a bittering agent and meant to balance any sweetness that comes out of the malt side of the drink. And there's an additional component of when you're putting in your hops, and of course, which ones you're choosing. Hops only grow at certain latitudes around the world, and they have distinctive, to use your word, terroir characteristics to them based on where they come from in the world. So we use, obviously, Irish barley and roasted malts and so forth. And our hops come from the latitude across both Ireland and the United Kingdom.
You mentioned the Academy Award winning animation studio, but I'm looking at a note here about your Maltings Red Ale winning the Oscars of the beer world.
Yeah.
What was that?
That was great because at the time when we launched the... So we jumped into business finally in the spring of 2016. We opened a tap room in Kilkenny. We distributed a little bit throughout Ireland. By January of 2017, we were launched in Buffalo, our only U.S. market at the time. And in the spring, the oldest beer competition in the world is where I alluded to earlier. It's at Burton-on-Trent. I believe it's called the International Brewing Awards. And we entered our Red Ale. Guess what? It was our only beer. So we entered that. Now, you had over 50 master brewers. To be a master brewer, you have to have brewed for 25 years. And judging blind, they assessed beers from around the world. And the master brewers were also from around the world. And our Red Ale won top honors, best ale in the world out of 1,200 entrants. And the thing that was astounding about that, I'm not astounded now that we're further along and I know Ian, but what's astounding about it really is that no Irish brewery had ever won that award and no Irish brewery has won it since. Oh. So to make our original beer such a calling card was very, very significant. And, you know, it doesn't take a PhD degree to realize that the dominant red ale in the world is Smithwick. And so now a new alternative red ale has sprung up from the Sullivan's line that really became, like I said, our calling card.
That's great.
So talk to us about scale. Obviously, yeah. You know, you've got 800-pound or 8,000-pound gorilla Guinness. I'm not sure how much Smithwick produces. And then there are all these tiny little craft brewers.
Yeah.
Where do you sit in that ferment? Where do you hope to go?
Yeah, sure. It's funny. In Ireland itself, there's one thing that benefits us, and that is that, so if you're a brewer, you're generally a scientist to some degree, or you fancy yourself as one at any rate. And what would be the most fun if you were a brewer would probably be to create different ales constantly, different lagers constantly, trying your hand at different beer types. And if you're Ian, I think what is fun is he had been, if you will, at Big Beer his whole career. And his aspect of being a kid in a candy shop is really that he's crafted his own recipes for the first time in his life, right?
Because before he just had to be consistent.
Right? Yes. Yeah. So now he gets to come up with his own recipes and drive that consistency point. But again, what benefits us, I think, in Ireland from a competitive point of view, and hats off to everybody, and by the way, we have good working relationships with a number of them, is that I often see Irish breweries today replicating the craft beer movement that began in whatever, 1995 and beyond, which again appeals to that brewer who wants to create, right? You know, we talked about just basic ales and lagers, but what about putting some fruit in there and making a sour, right? And that's creative license for a lot of the brewers. And so they're doing that. So there are a couple of folks, and we brew at their places at times, who are doing great work selling all types of beer styles, you know, all through Eastern Europe, Italy, the Baltic republics and things like that. And hats off to them. For ourselves, to quote Ian, sorry, Ian, is that our radicalism is in our traditionalism. Wow. So, you know, what we're doing is we've got a playbook and we're trying to bring traditional Ireland to the world as best we can. Now, I don't want to get over our skis here on to the world, but I think you get the sentiment. And so we're just bringing traditional Irish ales out. And so if you look at kind of volumes, loosely speaking, in terms of what we're doing, really probably 95% of our business is for export, but that's really only because our home market, our home country is a small place,
right?
Right. today, if you took a snapshot, 65-67% of our business is exported to the United States. And then we call it ROW, rest of world, is where the rest of it's going. So you can kind of see where that is. And on a competitive basis, and I don't think we need to think about it that way, a couple of those breweries are exporting more than we are because they've got significant, let's say, contracts with global grocery chains and so forth. Plus, they make good beer in their own right. And then there's us, who's nipping at their heels maybe, and probably a few years behind on their current volume, with the one saving grace for us, and that is that we have really very significant distribution in the U.S., and that's not what you're seeing from the other Irish breweries at the moment.
You know, Michael, let's take a look at the time you're in right now. We mentioned in our Irish Libation series that we talked to a new kind of startup whiskey distiller in our last episode. And there was a time in the United States there were essentially four versions of Irish whiskey that was available. Now it's endless, which is good in one way. And how do you make yours rise to the top? So you're in a time, I think most Americans would have known Guinness in the bottles,
yep,
and they would have known Harp, and that was about it. So you're in a time when this sort of craft beer and new versions of beer are really taking off. Tremendous opportunity, but again, another type of challenge. How do you break through?
Well, I think the American market has proven that the consumer wants variety, really, right? And so what we tend to notice when we're doing beer festivals, pouring at festivals and these zoo events and everything else that are going out there, what we tend to notice is that at the end of the session, everybody's over at our tent because they've sampled unique beers, but then they just want to get down to having a beer. And I say that not with any kind of hubris. I mean, this visually happens at these events. So I think despite the fact that people want variety and choice, I think what's nice about having somebody with Ian's caliber and training and background and so forth is that at the end of the day, people respect our beers in the sense that they know that it's fine, high quality product.
Right.
So we're finding ourselves as a great example. We're nationally in all the Yard House locations in America. Now, those are 100 taps on the wall places, but they want to find unique, great beers that will turn over. They want to rate a sale on that draft line. They don't want to have it sit there and get dusty. So we get that respect still in, you know, that rotating world or variety world, the same way we're getting respect from Irish nationals and Irish Americans that own bars and restaurants and concept hospitality groups over here, that they want an authentically Irish product.
You know, we've been talking business and science and the sort of serious aspects. Your face lit up when you started talking about the tastings and how people start coming over to your tent and all that. I mean, it sounds like a gas.
I'd be lying if I told you my friends didn't want to beat me up. I'm a boy and it's beer, so those are pluses. It's obviously very socially interactive as a business. It comes with a lot of challenges, which I'm happy to get into if you'd like, but it's a tough road. At the end of the day, oldest commercial brewery in Ireland, but this relaunch is really a startup in that aspect. And then you go to where we are now, an emerging growth company. There's a lot of challenges to it, but the best part is the people part, interacting with folks, introducing them to a new brand. I do like to say, geez, you know, when's the last time an Irish brewery knocked on the door and asked you to buy their product? You know, it's not happening to a food and beverage manager every day.
Right.
It's also convenient for us that Harp has been completely de-emphasized in Ireland itself.
What's that?
Harp.
Harp
Lager.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think people are starting to get a grip on that over here as well. So there's an opening. I also think that, you know, hoppy beer, IPAs and so forth, or I happen to like a sour, but I don't have three of them, right? They're a palate cleanser to me, but I quite enjoy them. You know, there's an opportunity here for down the middle alcohol content, beers where you can have, you know, a few and not get knocked out of your chair, and beers brewed in a traditional sense. So when people ask me who our competitors are, it's funny because, you know, I tend to think of Belgian beers, long history and provenance, truly caring about the craft angle to their recipe creation and the production of their beer, and being unique. Versus if you think of us in just an import category, I mean, who's my competitor? Heineken? Yeah. You know, it's not really the point. We're trying to be, if you will, exporters of premium crafts.
So we've talked, obviously, a bit about the business, but let's talk a little bit about the community you find yourself operating in right now. What did it mean to Kilkenny to bring brewing back, and what are some of the considerations of setting up operations in Kilkenny again? And of course, you have broken ground apparently on a new brewing facility in Kilkenny. So give us your sense of the lay of that land, the challenges, the benefits, etc.
You know, I think of my role as kind of, I have the privilege of helping to guide the Irish team in the relaunch of this product. I'm kind of a little sensitive about the idea that I'm an Irish American doing what I'm doing, right? So if there's one thing that Dan and Alan and Ian and Dave and Franz on our team, Brandon, deserve, it's that we fulfill the promise of bringing brewing back to Kilkenny. If, again, you take that Rust Belt example, the visceral reaction of a town losing its kind of core and soul. Don't forget, monks have been brewing there for 800 years. So, you know, hey, to have that just kind of go away is kind of monumental. So to deliver on this, break ground, geez, in the last week, the foundation's been poured. And just today, the beginning of the first wall has gone up. It's a big deal. We think about Kilkenny as our spiritual home because it is the brand home. But I think that makes it a tangible home once that building's done. Everybody loves our tap room. It's wildly overbooked. It's a nice experience for all genders, children, dogs, and everybody, you know, the typical craft beer experience and so forth. But I think just to see the kettles and to see some steam coming out and to see that we've accomplished what we said we would do is an ode to what needs to happen for the town, to be honest. And if you talk about challenges, when you're looking to dig in a medieval city, they call it planning permission. You know, you go for planning permission and approvals. You know, you're hoping you don't find bones and shields and swords and everything else, let alone touching the city wall, the medieval wall, and things like that. All of which, you know, we dealt with the wall a little bit, but we didn't deal with any human remains or weaponry or anything like that. So that's allowed us to get to the point where we're at right now.
We've had some archaeologists on from Ireland who have talked about being the ones who do find the bones and find as they're building a road or building a building.
Right.
So when this facility is completed, is it contemplated as a destination facility? You mentioned the fact that you have a tap room. Is it located in the town or is it on the outskirts of the town or how does that work?
It's right in Kilkenny city center. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, as the crow flies, it's probably, you know, 100 yards, 150 yards, put that in meters for me, would you, from Kilkenny Castle, which is obviously the centerpiece of the city, and the River Nore, which is right there. So it's right where you want to be. That's where our tap room already is. And it's being built just really literally adjacent to it, across an alleyway. And I think what it does, we'll have more outdoor space once the site is built. We'll round it out with further outdoor space. And I can't emphasize to you or enlighten you enough on the amount of musicians that come in and play already. We're linked in tightly to CIB, and I know you know the folks there. We're linked in tightly to a local bicycle touring club. We do a lot of, you know, international byway kind of work and thinking about, you know, sponsor some USGAA teams and bring them over. We're really trying to bring it to be a must-see, and I think it will be. I think the tap room has already in and of itself done a good job of that. But to now be also brewing there, and it will give us a chance to experiment with some, you know, maybe more one-off type of beers.
Right.
Have some fun with that.
Yeah, just in the location, yeah. Special this summer, that
yeah.
Type of thing. That's
exactly.
Great. Exactly. You happy? You know, I've been a little bit thirsty here as we've been talking. I would love to actually experience one of your beers. Do you happen to have one with you?
Yeah, I read the memo. I had to write it.
Well, that wasn't very subtle.
We'll take a brief pause and let's break them out.
Very good.
I got some glasses here.
Good.
Beautiful.
I do want to hear that.
Yeah, let's see. So we're just opening up the Maltings Red Ale,
which is all I brought.
Yep, okay. That's good. Keep it simple.
Yes, the calling card, right?
And we on your website, there's a great review. Was that on the website of this?
It was actually an Irish Echo article.
Irish Echo article, right? Good point. Mm-hmm. Of your really great English beer guy reviewing your.
He was enthusiastic.
Yes, glowing terms.
He's a character.
He loved the can and the label. It's an attractive can. Shows the sort of the skyline, I guess you'd call it, of Kilkenny, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. We took the main kind of notable buildings and blended them together mm-hmm. for our branding. And our glassware reflects the same. Again, named after the original brewery building, Maltings.
Well, the motto at the bottom is brewing is in our blood. So let's put some of this into our blood here. What can you tell us about this?
Well, let's look at this for a minute. I think the first thing you see, and regrettably, you've probably had a Smithwick's or two, right? So, you know, I'm kidding.
Snap.
We always have fun with that. But what you see if you were to compare this red ale to Smithwick's is that you would find Smithwick's to be a lot more translucent.
Yeah, this is much darker.
It's a really deep ruby red we have here. And again, that would go back to our what we call our grain bill, which malts and mix of malts we have in here. And of course, that gets closer to the top secret side of things.
Yep.
You also get a very, to me, caramely aroma to it, mm-hmm. which, you know, gives you an inkling that you might find more body in this beer. For me, I that stares. Now, the fortunate thing about me and my role is that I grew up preferring red ale, brown ale, stouts. So I'm a darker beer person.
Right.
And of course, the misnomer is that darker beer is necessarily stronger beer.
Right.
So here we are. So let's take a sip. So again, if you harken back to really the other main red ale in the world, it's quite a bit different, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There, when we talk about tasting notes, we think about the balance here. You're not getting hot bitterness per se. You're getting a warmness of... you know, in Ireland, we'd say biscuit. Here we might mean, you know, a dark cookie or a graham cracker, a little toffee action in there. And so the beer has complexity. And that's, I feel, aside from winning the award and being recognized for its complexity and uniqueness, I think that's what appeals to beer geeks and not just people who enjoy beer. You know,
it's a traditional Irish style of beer, the red ale. Is that unique to Ireland? Mm-hmm. Does it have its roots in Kilkenny?
Well, it really does if you think about it. You know, over here in the States, we have the Beer Judging Certification Program, BJCP, and they've done a great job of taking global beers and creating the categories of what is the beer style and its definitions. And you have to fit parameters, alcohol content, color, and bitterness being the primary ones. And so, yes, this is within the style, the definition. And has taken some liberties on being a little bit darker, being a little bit maltier, and being, like we set out to do, a little unique.
I like it. I think it's...
Very nice.
It has... Well, I like dry things, and it has a certain degree of dry. I guess biscuit is probably what you call that.
Right.
I drink a bit of wine, so I think of it maybe in those terms. But it isn't without its sweetness, so there's kind of a nice balance there. Very pleasant.
Mm. Yeah. Well, this would play very well paired with barbecue, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, so you can go Americana here if we need to. Mm-hmm. And so we found good success placing the beer in places like that.
You can kind of see with like a fish and chips is like the malt vinegar sort of.
Yeah, so we have a few restaurants around the country actually using it in the batter, the beer batter, for sure. We have with our stout, which I didn't bring today, we've seen that used in dessert dishes. Of course, it complements quite well, you know, a dark molten cake or whatnot. I think the misnomer around oysters was fabricated, but so stouts are good with things like that. And then our golden ale is nice because it's got enough hoppiness. I call it hops on the finish for my taste buds, as opposed to an IPA, which hits you on the front of your teeth. I find it does well to cut through spicy food.
Right.
So it might pair well with a Thai dish and so forth. So those are general, you know, there's always in food pairings with beer, the idea of do you try to match or do you try to counter?
Right.
And probably not that dissimilar with wine, right?
Did you know this kind of language and way of looking at beer before you started brewing yourself?
Oh, just sitting on a fixed income trading desk. Yeah, like we just talk like this regularly. No, everybody knows what a sommelier is, but not everybody knows what a Cicerone is. And a Cicerone is sort of the equivalent type of curriculum to learn beer. Oh. So I set out, I don't think you could have my role without having done a fair amount of study in that regard, to really understand what you're dealing with. Otherwise, you know, you might be a little fallacious or, you know, not really accepted by the right people on the beer geek front and so forth.
Here's a question for you. Would you agree with this statement by Billy Carter, the famous beer drinking brother of Jimmy Carter? There is no such thing as bad beer. It's that some taste better than others.
I'd wildly disagree with that. I think that is very interesting. I think there's a lot of bad beer, and I think we're fortunate to have been recognized for making good beer. Oftentimes, I just also think of when we were growing up in America, you know, in Ireland, the hospitality business is so fine-tuned. It's just ridiculously well-run. You feel it from walking in and talking to the first person at a hotel desk. Yeah. All the way into their restaurant bar and in the hotel and keep on going to pubs and so forth. But in the U.S., we never had a culture of cleaning beer lines, which is a critical component to sanitation, wellness, and then ultimately to the flavor of beer. And so many of us grew up not appreciating draft beer because it was tough on our stomach, right? So for me, the idea of bad beer, it's out there.
And then
what shouldn't be confused, though, in my judgment there, is just because I don't like the beer doesn't mean it's not a good beer,
right?
Everybody's got a different palate, or like I said, I prefer maltier, darker beers to the next person. Doesn't mean this IPA isn't stellar representation of the beer style.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're getting to that point in time where we have to trot out our friend, Seamus Plug. So, what is your Seamus Plug, Michael Mead?
Uh-huh. Couple of things. Just succinctly, when given an opportunity to chat with folks, I really want to let people know, especially those with Irish affinity, Irish heritage, and so forth, that we're trying to become Ireland's next great export company. Top to bottom, that's the goal of what we're trying to do. We're also embarking on a lot of capital expenditures, and so we're doing a capital raise towards that end. So that's Seamus number one, Seamus plug. My Seamus plug number two would be to embrace change and embrace different flavor profiles, embrace new brands, embrace the fact that Ireland is exporting a new kid on the block, and to get involved and to try it. And I don't want to focus just on here we are sitting in America, but really anywhere that we're selling beer, domestically in Ireland or some unique countries that we sell beer in, like Israel. Embrace the new brand. Give it a try. See if you like it. If you do, please keep coming back for more.
And I'd say next time you're in Kilkenny, stop by the tap room. And
Absolutely.
Pretty soon you'll be able to stop by the brewery itself.
Exactly. And we'll welcome you with open arms. And geez, I must get 3 photos a week of somebody who knows somebody who's in our tap room right now. So that's a thrill for all of us. And by the way, Alan Smithick deserves special credit with his wife, Bridget, for being an incredible host there.
Well, I'll be there in a month.
Excellent. We'll make sure that's well paved.
Great.
And with that, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of John and me, and a cheers before the wonderful biscuit flavors of Sullivan's Maltings Irish Ale kicks in too much further. I'd like to thank Michael Mead for giving us a wonderful tour de force understanding of beer, brewing, and what it takes to bring a special new product to the market.
Sláinte.
Sláinte.
Sláinte mhath.
Michael Mead, he was born in Buffalo and was a big business success in New York City. And now he's in the beer business in Kilkenny, where they have just broken ground on a new brewery.
And throughout the conversation, you saw a guy with a sense of vision, real commitment to what he's doing, and creating community in his business pursuits. And we also saw he has a commitment to an outstanding product, which we were able to sample there with our tasting of Sullivan's Malting Irish Ale, one of several ales that Sullivan's is putting out. And I'm looking forward to seeing what's over there in Kilkenny soon.
You're going to get the opportunity faster than me, John. I'm jealous of that. Kilkenny, it's such a great destination, and it's great to see brewing back in the town after the sad departure of Smithwick's. And guess what? I've drunk Smithwick's. Now I've drunk Sullivan's. Who wins? Well, for my money, it's Sullivan's. And I think what's also interesting about our conversation with Michael Mead is his background. He's had 20 years of experience on Wall Street. And consequently, he brings a financial rigor to a business where that's sometimes lacking. And with that combination of talents, I wouldn't be surprised to see Michael Mead emerging as the next beer baron.
And you know, it says on the bottom of every can, brewing is in our blood.
Irish Stew is produced by John Lee, Martin Nutty, and Bill Schultz. Editing, mixing, and mastering by Bill Schultz. Music on Irish Stew was composed and performed by Rosa Nutty, with Donald Bowens on drums, Cathal O'Riordan on bass and synthesizer. For more on Rosa Nutty's music, please visit rosanutty.com.